Welcome back to The Undiscovered You, a podcast for people who feel like they have so much more to offer but are somehow stuck where they are. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnston, and today I'm speaking to Kirsty Andrews, who is an underwater photographer by night and an in-house lawyer by day. She's also a multi-award-winning photographer, a monthly columnist for Scuba Magazine that has a circulation of over 30K. She's an author in terms of being a contributor to Wild and Temperate Seas, which is a book all about scuba diving in the UK. Welcome to the show, Kirsty.
Hi, thanks for having me.
100% excited to hear about scuba diving and photography in the UK, two things I would never put together. Scuba diving and the United Kingdom. Tell me a little bit about that. What in the world are you seeing around the waters of the United Kingdom?
Well, you're not alone in that opinion, I'd say. And that's part of the thrill for me, actually, is trying to talk to people about how great it is and how accessible it is and the types of fantastic things that you can see. I mean, I'd say our shores are full of life, and more so, in fact, than lots of places around the world. They're a bit colder, and so you need to make sure you're wearing the right kind of gear. But you can see some fantastic things. I mean, if you're into really big, exciting animals, then we have over 20 types of shark in UK waters, and we, including the second biggest shark in the sea across the whole world, the basking shark. We've got important colonies of grey seals, which are really fun to snorkel with. Beyond that, we've also got incredibly colourful waters that are full of life. And yes, sometimes weather's not conducive, like for the last couple of weeks, unfortunately. But when it is good, it really is fantastic diving in the UK.
Amazing. And so how long have you been doing this for? When did you get into scuba diving, and did the photography come with it, or did the photography come first and then the scuba diving? How did this all work out for you?
Not at all. I was a terrible beginner with photography. I had to give some thought to this in advance of the interview and toss up some sums. And I suppose there've been definite phases in my love of obsession with preoccupation with scuba diving. And it's actually been, well, over 20 years. I started when I was 18.
Mm-hmm. So you can do the sums. You just gave her age away.
As a young thing about to go to university, I did a working gap year, but right at the end of it, I went to Thailand, like so many thousands of other people, and learned to dive when I was 18, which was fantastic. And then I went to university, and although I went to university in Leeds originally, which is literally as far from the sea as you can get in the UK, the Sabacwa Club there was really vibrant, great community, and I loved that. I really blossomed, and it for me at that time, it was all about being a member of the British Sabacwa Club and teaching, so sort of getting my qualifications and then teaching others, and that community was brilliant, and that was my sort of initially what I got out of scuba diving. And then I think what kept me in was love of wildlife and learning more and more about the types of life we have in the sea, and that naturally seeped into wanting to take photos of it. I had friends who got into that before I did. I was probably a bit of a late starter. It's probably about halfway through my diving career that I picked up a camera. I remember there's a dive show every year where manufacturers and holiday companies and get together and talk about stuff we love doing. And I remember I picked up a secondhand camera from someone at that show, and also a copy of Martin Edge's book, The Underwater Photographer, which is the sort of the Bible, I suppose, the manual for beginners. And I took both of them the next week on holiday with me, and on a Red Sea liverboard where I was just diving all day. And before every dive, I'd be flicking through going, what setting? Oh, what am I doing? Okay, give this a go. I was completely clueless, but I loved it. And ever since then, and that's over 10 years ago now, the photography has definitely been to the fore. So that's a long answer for you.
No, I love it. And when you were doing that, assuming that was all digital, so you were in a space where you're practicing on digital?
Yeah, that's right. I've got lots of friends who started before digital. And I think actually when I first did my course, we were given a camera and on film, but that doesn't really count, I think. So yeah, I never experienced the real challenge of underwater photography on film. Yeah, as I say, friends of mine had a Nikonos 5 and that type of camera, which actually produced great results. But my goodness, I don't know if I would have been capable, because there's so many things you've got to get right, and then you don't find out until you develop your film whether you got them right. And oh my goodness, I'm in total awe of those people who managed it then, and I'm very grateful to have my digital camera.
Yeah, and I mean, anybody that's gone on holiday with one of those underwater film cameras can attest to the fact that the photos are never great. You know, you have a couple that may have come out really well. So I can imagine if your job is to catch the right photo, and actually you're sitting there with the pressure of that, and knowing it's film, and knowing you only have, you know, 32 shots or whatever it is, it would be quite an experience. So I think there's probably some joys in being able to have the digital side of things, but also, you know, I think you still have to do a lot of post-production. So it's not like you got the shot and that's it. You actually have to take time in post-production, don't you?
Yes, still definitely. And I enjoy that. We talk about it as the digital dark room. And some photographers may be a bit poo-poo about processing. Some people are real geniuses, and it's only the start of the process, taking the photo. And I suppose I'm somewhere in the middle. I do think it's a necessary part of creating the image that you want to do some processing. And it's just another skill, which I quite enjoy getting the hang of.
What do you use, just out of interest, for your processing?
For almost all of it, I use Adobe Lightroom, yeah, which is really easy to use and has incredible amounts of things you can do with it.
That's great. So tell me a little bit about your monthly columnist in Scuba magazine. What type of stuff do you write about?
Well, my brief is anything I want, which is a little bit worrying.
So bread baking.
No, it's got to be scuba related. Yeah, I suppose whatever has happened to me takes my fancy, relating to the world of scuba. So I try and vary it a little bit. So I might interview someone, as you're doing with me now, but on a very much shortened scale. I might talk about a location that I've been to recently. I might maybe just a feature of diving, which looking at it again, I think is something very odd. One of my favorite columns I wrote just after we were allowed to dive again post-COVID was about mask spitting, which is, if you are already a scuba diver, you'll know that it is quite common across the world. Some countries tend to use artificial sprays, but in the UK we very much spit in our masks so that we can see in it, and it's a bit of an essential. But in a world of COVID, we suddenly realized, oh, hang on, this has other factors that we need to think about. Yeah. So it's just a commentary on diving life, I suppose.
And what was your most recent article on? So the one that you just published.
There've been a couple of good ones recently. I think I've got Scuba Mag on my doorstep. I haven't opened it yet. And it's actually the 70th anniversary of the British Subaqua Club. So again, mm-hmm, looking back to the pioneers of the past is just incredible, I think. And so the one hot off the press that I haven't opened yet is about my appreciation, actually, for those diving pioneers. I recently went on a dive trip to St Kilda, which is one of the most far-flung outreaches of the British Isles. Mm. And I was thrilled to even get out there, because you got to get the right weather to get out there. And then it's visually spectacular. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, both above and below the water. So a really brilliant place.
Where is it? North, south, east, west?
It's very west. So it's west of the Outer Hebrides.
Okay. Wow.
It's 40 miles from the nearest bit of Outer Hebrides. So,
and how do you get there?
On a liveaboard, a boat that we live on, which, if you're overseas, liveaboards tend to be incredibly glamorous and full of all types of luxury. Whereas in the UK, they're often converted fishing boats. So a bit of a different experience, but but nonetheless good and fun. And that was great. But my column was actually just appreciating that before I was born, even, I think, a chap called Gordon Ridley had written a guide to diving in St Kilda. He founded an expedition scheme, and he ran some expeditions, you know, again, before the sort of nice big boats that we've got now were being used. And he wrote this guide to diving with some beautiful illustrations and 180, I think, different dive sites. And, you know, that is something that I can use now to inform myself. And, you know, I think that's great. I think I really feel that power of contributing to wider knowledge and wanting to do that. But I think if I go back to my previous article as a contrast, I wrote about when I bumped into a great white shark underwater earlier this year. So that was good.
Wait, sorry. Back that one up again. You bumped into a great white shark. Tell me more.
Well, actually, thankfully, I didn't bump in literally. I was probably about 2 meters away at the closest, but that's still pretty close.
That is really close. Where were you?
I was in South Africa in Aliwal Shoal.
I'm really, really glad to say you weren't like in Bournemouth or, you know, right off down in Dorset, you know, somewhere right off the coast. So you're down in South Africa diving where one might think that there may be a great white nearby. And you happen to come upon one, but that's pretty close quarters to be next to a great white.
Yes, it is. I will seek just to say that I wouldn't rule out having great whites in UK waters
soon.
Soon or even now, and we don't know about it. It's quite possible on their routes. We've got food for them here. and yes, as waters change, perhaps. But yes, more likely in South Africa, although actually not. It wasn't quite the season for them, so it was a surprise. And we were just doing a normal dive on the reef, and the shark swam towards us. It was absolutely incredible. And she was a female, and she was, I think, certainly between 4 and 5 meters in size, really, really large. Just one, and swimming directly towards me, I would say, as well.
And is that like a danger moment where you're like, she thinks I'm a seal, I'm about to get eaten? Like, what's going through your head in that moment?
No, well, no. I don't know if I'm I don't know if I'm just foolish. I mean, I love sharks. I think they are incredible.
They're beautiful.
Mm. And so I think mainly to the extent that I was thinking, and I'm not sure how much I was actually thinking, I was thinking, come close so that I can take a photo.
Yeah.
The obsessive underwater photographer. And my strobes only carry it probably a couple of meters at most. So she has to be pretty close for me to get what I would consider a usable photo. And she was quite relaxed. So you can tell the shark's body language broadly. And I could tell that she was very relaxed. The fins were out wide and just curious. But having said that, of course, she can change that quite quickly. And she's a wild animal. And I suppose it's not the type of thing that I worry about, because if she were going to bite me or eat me or whatever, I would have had no say in the matter. And it probably would have happened before, or the catastrophic thing would have happened before I was aware of it. So it's not something that I worry about. And really, she was just curious about me and the group. And when my flash went off, when I took a photo, she actually wasn't sure, what's this? I wasn't expecting that, and turned away from me and towards the other divers. And then when she saw the group of divers, she thought, oh, there's a lot of you actually, and swam off. So it was wonderful, but it was quite brief.
Dang. And I love that you can kind of tell the body language of the shark the same way you think about, you know, you can tell if a horse is angry, you can tell if a dog's angry. And the more time you spend with them, the more you can recognize that. And so I think, you know, because we have this innate fear against sharks because of things like Jaws and all the different movies that we've seen that, you know, the sharks come and attack people. I wonder if actually we took the time to kind of recognize the same way you would with a dog. Like, there are certain dogs you wouldn't go up and pet because you can see they're in a state of anxiety, or, you know, they're snarling, for instance, or they are barking. You can kind of, you know, the signs. And I wonder if we actually knew that about sharks, whether we'd have a different relationship with them. You said fins out. What else do we need to be looking for? Just in case, you know, we're scuba diving and this lovely female great white is coming towards us and we're super relaxed. How do we know if she's relaxed?
Well, yeah, as I say, out wide tends to be more relaxed. And as there's maybe some more emotion, the fins drop and become sort of rigid. I'm by no means a shark expert, but I try and educate myself as much as possible. And there's certainly different types of sharks that are more of a threat. And usually it's because of how sophisticated their senses are, actually. So bull sharks have been responsible for a lot of fatalities and things. And that tends to be because they're not very sophisticated in their sight and their smell in comparison with some sharks. And so they're more likely to mistake usually a swimmer or a surfer for their prey, whereas other sharks less so. And I mean, by a factor of many, many times, we are more of a threat to sharks than they are
yeah.
to us.
Especially, yeah, boats and jet skis and big nets and all the rest of it. Yeah. And I mean, there's 200 and some odd species of sharks, and there are only several of them that would even harm you. Isn't there something, you probably know the stats a lot better than I do.
Well, I wish I'd got my notes with me, because I mean, there'd be more, as I say, there's over 20 species of shark in UK waters alone. So there's certainly more species than that, but we are, what with bycatch or long lining, then we are directly responsible for their deaths, but also in our destruction of their habitat and in climate change and changes there. You know, it's a really sad tale for them. And sharks, you know, we might think of them as big, scary predators, but it's certainly been shown that, you know, as a top predator, they are responsible for a healthy ecosystem. You know, so if we lose the sharks, then that impacts the sea as a whole.
Mm. I was watching a special and they were talking about, is it rockfish or something, that there's something they sell that is in fish and chip shops that's actually shark?
Yes, it might well be. Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called, but I think it was called rockfish or something, but it's actually
sometimes.
But maybe rock salmon. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was actually shark, which I was just like, and they did a whole bunch of, they took it and they studied it and they took it back to the labs and they're like, no, this actually is shark.
Yeah. There's a really good charity operating in the UK called Bite Back, who I'd recommend checking out, you know, on their social media and things, for educating yourself and your friends about that kind of thing.
Hmm. So this is something I really want to go back to, because something you said you've been doing this for about 20 years now. We know we've had a massive amount of climate change that's happened that's already impacted our waters around the world. We've seen, you know, there's lots of reports coming out around the Great Barrier Reef. If we get much more of an increase in water temperature, you know, that a lot of that's going to be dying. What have you noticed in terms of your diving, your photography, the waters around the UK or elsewhere, that you've seen the impact of climate change in the waters in general?
It's a really important question, and it is something I do think about, but I am conscious I'm not a scientist, and I wouldn't want to make sweeping statements without the backdrop to that. Mm. Certainly diving abroad, which I try and do sort of maybe once a year these days, you know, try and be a little bit thoughtful about travel. I have noticed going to the tropics that coral has bleached, even in the coral triangle, the sort of the most beautiful areas of underwater coral reefs in the world, in Indonesia and the Philippines, say coral bleaching, which is indicating that it's dying, and that's due to rising temperatures. And also in the wildlife that I've seen, there's effects called El Nino and La Nina, which are changes in the ocean currents due to climate change, which mean that cold water or warm streams aren't found perhaps where you might expect them to be, and that changes the wildlife. So I've had a few trips where I haven't seen the really big animals because the water's been warmer than normal and they've stayed very deep. So perhaps I might expect to see mantas, and they are there because scientists monitor them and perhaps have tagged them. And we know that they're on the site, but they're maybe 100 meters below where I am because the water's... But certainly seeing the bleached corals is a really sad sight. And in the UK, it's perhaps more difficult to tell, but I do think it's important, particularly people like me who dive in the UK a lot, to try and contribute to that data. So in recent times, I've tried, I'm not the best, but I'm trying to be better at recording what I see. And there's an organization called Sea Search that is citizen science arm of the Marine Conservation Society. And they collect reports both on dive sites and also on key species, so they can see populations as they ebb and flow. There have been some success stories. So things like crawfish in the 1980s and 1990s, there was an absolute population dive because they were overfished, not least by divers, actually, who picked them up. And when I started my diving career, I wasn't expecting to see one, wouldn't have known what one looked like, really. But now there was a no-take sort of more of a, I'm not sure to what extent it was legislation, but voluntary no-take in some cases, they can now be caught. But we are seeing them bounce back very much. And I often see them now on the South Coast, and people who are more rigorous with their science than I am have definitely seen that there's a real population boom, which is lovely to see.
That's so cool. Thank you for sharing a positive story. That's always good to hear as well. We had the same, I lived in Ecuador when I was in high school, and we had the pepinillo de mar, so the sea cucumbers were being overfished and were massively depleted. And they actually were used as a delicatessen in certain dishes. And so they actually had to get the Navy out there to protect the pepinillo de mar. And it was a proper like skirmish. Like it was a real thing because they were worth quite a bit of money for these fishermen. So yeah, it's interesting how sometimes, you know, you have to protect it in order to have it come back. And sometimes they're overfished, sometimes they're overcaught. And it's interesting to hear that you're not noticing anything specifically, like you're not seeing a depletion of something in your own dive. So you're not going back to the same place over and over and seeing a big change in the, I call it the flora and the fauna, but I don't know, what would the language be that you'd use for?
Yeah, flora and fauna, for sure. It's mostly fauna underwater. Yeah. Most things are animals, even if they look like plants.
I like it. So for people that wanted to dive in the UK, where would you say top places to go would be?
Ooh. So many places. I mean, I'm lucky. I live in Bristol, which I can achieve various coasts relatively easily. So I'll happily dive Devon, Dorset, Cornwall, Wales. And I particularly love Scotland and the various coasts of Scotland and some of the sea lochs there. So difficult to choose a favourite. I suppose if you're learning, then diving or snorkeling on the South Coast is probably a bit more achievable for a lot of people. It's a bit warmer and less scary, but there's so much to see. And yeah, Scotland's got a special place in my heart, I think.
Any place specifically in Scotland that you love?
Some of the sea lochs, they're all different. I've got a few favourites. And the West Coast. And the East Coast. Oh, it's too hard.
Like everywhere, anywhere.
They're all great.
And I hear there's a book called Wild and Temperate that you may have been a contributor to that might Wild actually be all sea. About. Yeah. So what is it? It's all about scuba diving in the UK, right?
It is. Yeah. So yeah. Probably a good one for getting some ideas about where to dive around. A chap called Will Appleyard put that together probably around COVID time when we had nothing better to do than put a book together. And it's a guide to diving spots across the UK. And he got some passionate people to talk about their favourite places. So there's a good area on Devon. There's specialists on the East Coast. I think Will did Dorset himself. And I covered some of my favourites right up in the far north of Scotland for that one.
Oh, and so is that available on Amazon or where can we get a copy of that?
It is, yeah. Wild and Temperate Seas.
Wild and Temperate Seas. Okay, fabulous. I think I'm going to grab that because I'm so curious about diving here. So I grew up in very warm climates, did a lot of like warm water scuba, a lot of warm water snorkeling, but then I've never even ventured. I barely have ventured in to go swimming, much less the water is so cold. So I think I need to get a wetsuit and I think I need to at least get a snorkel to start trying that out.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
So we're talking about balance. So really focusing a lot on your underwater photography and the scuba diving that you do and how, you know, this is something that you're really passionate about and that comes through pretty clearly. And I love it when people have passions alongside of their day jobs. So my first question is how much of your time, so if you were doing a pie chart with 100% of your time, and let's assume that, you know, 50% of it's sleeping, no, about, let's say.
I am good at sleeping.
Let's say a decent amount is sleeping. What percentage would you put on scuba and underwater photography and post-production and writing and doing all that? How much time do you think you spend?
Oh, wow. Well, being a lawyer, I should be good at measuring my time by the minutes, but I'll probably not. And I do work full time, although many friends joke with me that they don't think I do. It's funny that we try and cultivate this impression on social media and such, don't we, that we're always out having fun. But no, I do work full time. But then, yes, I suppose with almost all of my free time, I am either heading to the coast or planning a trip, looking at the weather forecast, hopefully, and or looking at my catalogue and maybe doing a bit of image polishing. I do spend a lot of time doing that, but I get a lot of enjoyment out of all of that. I'm lucky my partner's got similar obsessions to me, so I'm not going to put a number on it because that'll probably scare me. But yeah, it's most of my free time, I suppose.
And you just said something that's really interesting there. So your partner also are they into underwater photography and also into scuba diving, et cetera?
Yes, absolutely. So does that help? Yeah, it does help. But we egg each other on. We're probably both a bit competitive and we both love it. Absolutely. So that's brilliant.
Cool. And when you take the photographs, what are they used for? So do you have a gallery? Do you sell them online? What do you do with your photography?
I mean, the vast majority sit there on my hard drive and don't do very much, of course, because I enjoy the process of it and the taking of it. So even if I didn't do anything with them, I don't suppose that would matter too much. Because I still love scuba diving for the sake of it. Just the feeling of being weightless underwater. So cool. Is a one. And I still enjoy the challenge, the technical challenge of photography. So, you know, that is what the taking the photos is for, predominantly for me. But having said that, yes, there's also an aspect of it which is a bit competitive in trying to create the best photos I can and then pitting myself against my friends and beyond. So I help to run a photo group locally of other underwater photographers, and we sort of have a monthly competition. There's a British Society of Underwater Photographers, and we do the same. And then there's other competitions, whether it be underwater specific or wildlife more broadly. So I do sometimes enter some of those too.
And you've won a few. Tell us a bit about your winnings.
Yeah. It's terrible talking about your winnings because you think, what if I never win anything ever again?
Well, then you would have had these winnings to pin up. So let's hear about the ones that you've won already.
There's a lot of photo competitions out there. So if it's something people are interested in doing, you know, anything from sort of a magazine monthly competition to, you know, all kinds of things around. So I don't enter everything because I think you could do that as a full-time job. But some of them, when I really admire the quality of what they're putting together and the organization doing it, there's some good ones. So I suppose I'm really pleased to have done well in the British Wildlife Photography Awards a couple of times. I think I got some postcards made by them with one of my images. So I've got a collection of those at home, which I quite like. But yeah, I've been highly commended, and runner up is the highest I've got in there, but that's nice. Also, Underwater Photographer of the Year obviously plays to my strengths. That's a really highly rated competition amongst underwater photographers, of course. And I'm really proud, actually, that I've managed to get at least an image in there for the last 7 years. I think I've won one of the British categories 3 times. So that's, you know, I'm really proud of that. They, you know, thousands of entrants, not as many perhaps as enter British Wildlife Photography Awards, where it's not just underwater crazy people, but, you know, I'm pleased with that. And the European Wildlife Photography Awards, I got an image through to those a couple of years ago, which I really like, because looking at the collection of images that wins that, they are beautiful. They have a very artistic, stylish type of image that they award, and so I was just pleased to be part of the collection there, and that was a feather in my cap as well.
I bought the British Wildlife Photography Awards calendar for my daughter this year, and so every month we turn it over, and it is there They're beautiful images. There are some that are quite funny. There are some that are quite emotive. I really like it. And some of them have a bit of a social aspect to them too. Like you'll have, you know, a ring that's got like a ring, you know, for the, what are they called? I'm going to call it soda pop, which is such a American thing. So yeah, the plastic that's kind of around, you know, a fin or something on a turtle, or, you know, and that can be quite emotive as well. So I like the fact that photography can be art. It can be something that can share information with people. It can be funny, and it can also be something that's kind of highlighting a social issue that needs to be brought to life. And that works underwater as well, because we see a lot, obviously, in the news. We see lots of photography now because a lot of our news is on our phones. So I love the fact that it's able to be used in that way as well.
Yeah, increasingly so, I think. And the competition's trying to have an environmental message to them, and rightly so. And as a photographer, I don't want to see quite distressing images of wildlife being harmed in various ways, often by human hands, but it's an important message to get out there.
Yeah, it really is. So you're using quite a bit of your time on the photography. We're sleeping as well, and then we're working full time. Tell me about full time work. So this is not even 4 days a week, not even 4.5 days a week. This is 5 days a week that you're working.
Yeah, for now that's it. That balance works. We'll see moving forward. I'll always keep it under review, I suppose, but for now it works. Yeah, so yeah, I do work full time. I'm very grateful that I think my employer has whether it's my immediate team or the organization generally, they seem to have quite a positive and supportive attitude towards people having work-life balance, and that extends beyond maybe what might be standard to people like me, who are a bit unusual in how they want to spend all of their free time. But I still get support and an element of flexibility, and I really value that. I think it engenders loyalty in your employees when they feel that there's a bit of give and take on that front.
I think that's a really good point. And a lot of times when we talk about work-life balance, or balancing life in work and life out of work, because I think that there's life in work as well. I don't think it's like work and life balance. You know, we think about people with caring responsibilities, or we think about people that, you know, have something that they're dealing with outside of work that they need to be able to deal with. And I think it's really important, as you say, that it engenders loyalty when you also are able to do your passion projects outside of work. Because actually, when you're able to do the passion projects outside of work, you're able to bring that passion to the work that you're doing as well, because you're a happier, more well-balanced person. And you're not feeling like you're not doing what you want to do when you're at work. You're actually able to do your job when you're there, recognize the value of it, paying your bills, recognizing the fact that, you know, you've trained as a lawyer, you've spent a lot of time and effort to do this, and this is what your speciality is, and you can still do that as well as the time and effort you've put into this passion of scuba diving and of underwater photography.
Yeah, that's it. It's all part of the picture. Yeah, I do agree with you there. And obviously having a corporate job enables me to dedicate my time and resources elsewhere for the rest of my life. So for now, the balance is right. But I think all of us should be looking at that on an ongoing basis and seeing what works.
Yeah. And let me ask you, in terms of what you do that you think works well, so have there been times when things have been in better balance than not? And when has that looked well? And when is it maybe not, maybe fallen short of the word well?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a tricky one, isn't it? I think all of us, when we have a stressful time at work, we value perhaps a weekend, you know, the time when you're not at work for downtime, but that stress impacts us sort of mentally and physically in ways perhaps we don't envisage. And I've seen it to an extent with myself, but also with friends who've been really busy, and they come away with me for the weekend, and then their brain just can't keep up, and they make a stupid mistake. So for example, in cold British waters, they forget to do their suit up properly, and they get, you know, absolutely drenched. That is an absolute classic, and I often put it down to people who's just a bit frazzled. And generally speaking, I'm quite a relaxed person, and I can deal, but yeah, I do have my moments when it all gets a bit much. And I suppose sometimes I feel, you know, it's great to fill your weekends with brilliant, exciting things, but it is also important to have just a relax, actually, and perhaps not be doing anything. And so, well, but then it's always fun to plan a good, exciting dive. So yeah, I'm not sure I take my own advice on that one. But I think we need to keep an eye on ourselves to make sure that we're not doing too much, because ultimately scuba diving, it can be a risky activity, and you don't want to be going into it so tired that you're not prepared properly.
What I think is really interesting as well, and maybe this is one for you to answer, is you said when you're kind of weightless in the water and you're in there, you really enjoy that. Is that also rejuvenation time for you?
Definitely. Yeah.
Because I think there's that, you know, a lot of times people think, oh, I need downtime, so I need to sit on the couch and watch TV. And actually, that's not necessarily the best thing for you, because it is kind of, you know, your brain's still ticking along. You know, a lot of things that you watch can cause stress. You know, you'll have emotional reactions to things. So actually, you end up in a very heightened state of emotion when you watch certain things. And actually going out, going for a walk, or in your case, going scuba diving, or going for a swim, or listening to music, or reading a book, or just finding that space and time for yourself is really important. Because as you say, even if it's an exciting dive off the back of an exciting week, you know, you do need to be in a mental state where you can do that safely, or where you can show up to work in a way that's actually going to be beneficial for your employer, that you're not exhausted and, you know, falling asleep at your desk. And so it's quite interesting to hear you say that sometimes actually taking that time off at the weekend is actually the way that you need to operate in order to regenerate and to rejuvenate. And that is part of the balance. It's not just about, you know, what am I doing outside of work? What am I doing in work? It's also about, what are you doing to relax? What are you doing to reset? What are you doing to detox, to unwind, to actually just get your brain to be in a state of, I mean, it used to, you know, they used to have a Sabbath. It used to be a Sabbath that everything would shut down on Sundays, even all the shops and everything. You couldn't go and do anything on a Sunday, and everybody had to shut down. But now we're like a 24/7 cycle. And so you have to find that time in your own life that allows you to shut down.
I'm smiling because it is definitely still like that in Devon where my partner lives. Can't do anything on a Sunday. But yeah. I mean, you're right. Sitting on the sofa isn't usually the best answer every now and then, but you know, getting out and about and some fresh air and some sea air certainly does it for me. But maybe it's just a case of toning things down a bit. So perhaps instead of driving for 8 hours to get to Scotland, maybe just, you know, heading to the nearest bit of coastline instead. And yeah.
You get in the water just from the beach as well, or do you suit up and then just go straight in?
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you can do that for sure. I have some friends in Dorset who are always just heading in even to a couple of meters of water. And I was there doing that on a night dive myself last weekend. And it was absolutely fantastic. Just wading into the water, swimming out 5 minutes, and then in 3 meters of water there were these fantastic squid. I love cephalopods. I find them beautiful and fun and fascinating. So a really happy hour and a half in the dark hours on Saturday night, and that's just wading in. So you absolutely can do that. It's different to taking a boat or traveling a long way, but it's just as fun in many ways.
That's really cool. Well, it's almost reached that time for me to ask you our two final questions. So my first question for you is, along this journey, what have you discovered about yourself along the way?
Well, I suppose I've always been a bit of a slow learner about myself, it would be fair to say. And I think I've got to a place now, a pretty happy place, when I have my kind of corporate career, but I also pretty happy with the diving and photography side of it. And I guess it's been an outlet for a side of me that otherwise I was neglecting, which is partly creative, partly sort of learning and the competitiveness and the passion for sure. So I've learned a lot about myself in through this activity, in ways that, yeah, the rest of my life, I'd sort of focus on other things. So it's very, very precious to me.
I love it. And I like that idea of, you know, I often say finding that thing that you really love to do, if it's not in work, find it outside of work. So that you can just fulfill that passion. Cause sometimes you'll have, you know, if you're in high school, if you're in university and you do something really creative. So you do, you know, plays, or you do singing, or you do art, or you do, you know, diving. I mean, you were part of, you know, in your university, you were part of a dive club. And then you leave and you go out into the corporate world and you're not doing that anymore. There's actually a bit of a mourning, a bit of a loss from not being able to have those creative outlets. And so sometimes, you know, you do unhealthy stuff around that, and sometimes you find it in other ways. And so I love that you've been able to find that creative outlet. And I would encourage listeners, if they're feeling a bit of a drought around that, see if you can go and, you know, do an art class, or, you know, go find a scuba team that's near you. That, what are they called? You're not called scuba teams. What are they called? Dive club. Go find a dive club, or go find a dance class or something that can help you to have that outlet. Cause again, that's part of that balance, is finding the joy in life, finding the joy in what you do.
Yeah. And I suppose I haven't focused on it much today. I don't, not intentionally, but there's definitely the community side to that as well, which I've also found and really appreciate. So finding your tribe is a really valuable thing, isn't it? And it's quite a niche hobby that I have, but equally the people that also do that are good friends, and very precious relationships through that as well.
And I can imagine, like, having the like-minded people means you're spending the time with them, because you said you spend all your free time when you're not working doing this. And so it's actually, that's your group of friends. You can go diving with your partner. You can go off with friends on a weekend for a night dive, you know, in Devon. Like, you can find those ways to amalgamate the two, because you have those similar passions. And as you said, you found your tribe. I love that. And final question is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received, heard, overheard, read in a really good scuba magazine?
This is a tricky one. I've had good advice through over the years from a number of friends and contemporaries or mentors underwater. I often value constructive criticism. And I remember going on a workshop with Alex Mustard, who's a friend, but also an incredibly fantastic photographer and teacher, and him telling me that he did the whole sandwich of feedback, as you do, of saying that yeah, this is okay, but this is really not very good. And I do value that. I think you learn through people being honest with you. But having said that, also through my photo group, various chairmen of that over the years, Arthur Kingdon used to be chairman of BUPG, another fantastic photographer, and it's incredibly encouraging to up and coming new members. And he'd always find something nice to say about your photo when it was on screen, and if he couldn't think of anything, he'd sort of say, good effort, which is lovely. But in terms of advice, I think something which can be applied to what I do, but to any number of other things as well, is that whole principle that it's the time you put in beforehand that's so important, that preparation. And it is definitely true in what I do, because we have physical constraints diving as to how much time we can spend in the water, whether it's the cold or how much gas we've got with us or whatever. So you might only be on a day's diving spending 2 hours in the water, but before then you're spending time prepping your kit, choosing your camera, learning your techniques. In my case, I think it's really important to learn about the marine life you're looking to see, whether that be its behavior, when and where you're likely to see it, looking at the condition, you know, all of these things that you think about beforehand are so important. So, you know, the advice that I'm sure I've had in a number of ways over the years, and that I would give to others, is that time spent preparing for what you do is really valuable time, and it's all part of the fun as well.
Yeah, I love that. And even just, you know, your as we said, your passion comes through in this, but also the knowledge that you've acquired through this comes through as well. I know you said you're not a scientist, you're not an expert several times, but actually, I think you're probably getting pretty close. So, oh, this is an absolute pleasure. And Kirstie, thank you so much for sharing your love of diving. Thank you for teaching us a little bit about scuba diving in the UK. I'm definitely going to be picking up this book that you contribute to, Wild and Temperate Seas. It sounds fabulous. And just really sharing about the balance that you found and how you've managed to do that. And just really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Join me next time when I speak to our next guest about how they are balancing on the proverbial seesaw. If you're looking for an executive coach or want to get in touch, check out my website, kljconsulting.co.uk, or shoot me an email on the undiscoveredyoupodcast@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to support me in putting out more content, why not buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/undiscoveredyou. Don't forget to follow, subscribe, like, and comment below. And I hope that you're one step closer to discovering the undiscovered you.